Okay, I am Ellis from Switzerland and originally from California. You have this page with the three circles, and this content is called Comparative Worldviews. And it wants to compare three very basic absolute worldviews. It's a reductionistic presentation. So if you are a professional philosopher, you have to excuse me a lot because it's a little bit crude how it's organized. But I think it will also be helpful. Let me start with a story. Do you know the story of the New Age elephant?
Yes.
Anybody knows this elephant? Okay, there is a New Age elephant. And the elephant represents truth. And the people are blind people trying to find out what truth is. So the first blind person comes and finds the tail. And he says, aha, an elephant is like a rope. And the second one comes and finds the leg and says, no, an elephant is like a tree. And the third one finds the nose and says, no, an elephant is like a hose. And the fourth one finds the side and says, no, an elephant is like a wall. So they have two choices. They can either disagree, fight, and kill each other because of their own personal experience, or they can respect each other's faith journeys and live in peace. And this is the New Age message. There is truth, and we all have different experiences of this truth from our personal point of view. And we need to be humble enough to accept that other people's experience is just as valid as mine, and that I shouldn't try to tell them my experience is more real than your experience, because your experience might be stronger or make you cry or make you laugh, and mine is just calm. And so in a way, yours would be a bigger experience than mine. So I need to respect the Muslim and the Hindu and the Buddhist and the astrologer and whoever it might be, and to accept other people's faith journeys, because all truth is one truth. And this is a very powerful message and a very powerful story and illustration. And it can be very difficult to deal with. And so as Christians, when confronted with this, sometimes we find ourselves saying pretty stupid things, you know, like, well, yeah, I understand all that, but really my truth is the real truth. And then you look like an idiot. And people say, well, you're the cause of all the problems in the world. I mean, there's war because of people like you, because you think your way and your truth is the only way. Well, I would just like to ask you, do you find anything wrong with the elephant? Not with the people, but with the elephant. Do you object to this elephant? The elephant represents absolute truth. Is there anything wrong with this elephant? Okay. He's a symbol. He represents absolute truth. You're happy with this elephant? This elephant is okay. Mm-hmm. I do have a problem with this elephant.
Yes.
And anything else?
Well, he lives.
He lives.
He has a moving or some sign about. He's not static.
He lives. He breathes. He's there, but
he's not in contact.
He doesn't say anything. He is available to be discovered, but he doesn't tell the people about himself. He leaves them to be confused. And the absolute of the Bible is very different. God is there, there is one truth, but he tells us about himself. He is an active and communicative God. He is a personal absolute truth. And the elephant is static, as you say, and silent. And that's very different, because I am not static and silent, and you are not static and silent, and the people who are New Age people are not static and silent. So the absolute of the elephant is less complex than the people. And this is not satisfactory. The absolute should be more complex than the people. The source of reality should be more complex than the product or the result that comes. But the elephant is less complex than I am. I speak, I move, I do, I communicate, I have personal relationships, but the absolute truth does not. It's silent and passive. I don't only wait to be discovered. I say, I am Ellis. I tell about myself. And so it seems to me that a truth that is absolute should tell about itself, should not just wait to be discovered. That's not satisfactory for me. And this is a very important uniqueness about the Bible. It describes a personal communicative truth as absolute. And we'll look at some of the details about what that means when we look at this page. Now, almost everyone in the world, especially all religious people, have a similar understanding of the history of reality. Almost everyone believes that once upon a time, in the beginning, everything was perfect. So Buddhists believe that, Hindus believe that, Christians believe that, Muslims believe that, astrophysicists believe that there was a perfect primordial molecule or a perfect singularity. Atheists believe that, that originally there was some kind of a perfect situation. And almost everyone believes something has gone wrong. It's not the way it should be. It's been distorted. It's been damaged. It's not the way it was. It's not the way it should be. Something is wrong. And we need to look for how it can be made right again. Okay? Now, as a Christian with the Bible, this is your view. God is perfect. God is love. God is truth. God is light. He made the world, and the creation was perfect. It is good. It is very good, he said, when he made the creation. So everything was perfect. Something has gone wrong. Sin. Now it's broken. It's twisted. There's suffering. There's alienation. There's hatred. Death. And it needs to be made right again by Jesus. So this is our history. Well, almost everyone you meet will have the same basic outline of history. It was perfect. Now it's not. It will be. And this is something we have in common. You don't have to argue about this. You can stand next to the non-Christian person and say, we agree. We live in the same situation.
Would a humanist think that too? Like, oh, we come out of whatever evolution and stuff, and life was very hard in former times, but now we're getting better and better. So they might agree, like, how can we make life on this planet better?
Yes, you might find exceptions to this. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that particularly religious people, that almost all religious people, there would be some atheists, like humanists or existentialists, who would either believe that the beginning was chaos, which is very difficult to really hang on to, that we started with chaos and now there is increasing order. We don't know why. This is very difficult to hold intellectually. An existentialist might say everything that is, and there is no should. It's very difficult to live like that, because if I drop a brick on your foot, you cannot complain. You have to say, well, that is, you dropped a brick on my foot. It's painful. It's not right or wrong. It's just what is. So in existentialism, there is no place to complain and to say this is wrong, because nothing is wrong and nothing is right. Everything just is. And so we act because our action is, and that validates our being. But there's no right or wrong. So those would be exceptions. But religious people, New Age people, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, Zoroastrianists, whoever it is, would believe in a perfect beginning. So it's very important to have a clear idea of what perfect is. What was it like when it was perfect? Because then we know what's wrong. If we don't know what it was like when it was perfect, we only know I'm uncomfortable now, but I don't know why. I don't know what the problem is. I just hurt. I go to the doctor and I say, I don't feel good. And he says, well, how is that different from the way you normally feel? And you say, well, I don't know what normal is. So I can't tell you. We can't live with this. We need to be able to say, this is what it's supposed to be. This is the original way that it is. And so this is what has gone wrong. And then this is what needs to be done to solve it, to make it right again. So you can see, knowing the Bible, that that's a very clear picture. But it's also true of these other absolutes. Now, in simplifying this, I have just said that it's 1, 2, 3. So it's really very simple. Monism, dualism, Trinitarianism. Thousands of years ago, people looked around them and they saw that there was a very strong unity in reality. They saw there was one earth, one sky, one sun, one moon, one cycle of day and night, one cycle of four seasons, one human race, a very strong unity. And so they reasoned that unity, oneness, is the original perfection. Because they, in their experience of diversity, different people, different things, they could never find perfection. But the unity is still very strong in our experience, and so they reasoned there must have been a perfect unity in the beginning, and we still have a shadow of that unity, but what we need is to have the perfect unity again. And so this is the basic idea of the New Age movement of Hinduism and Buddhism. The New Age slogan is, all is one. You may have heard this. All is one. And if all is one, then you are God. How could you not be? If everything is one, and God is, you have to be God. Which is fine. It's not insulting. I feel okay about being God. If all is one, then I am God. But let's explore what that means, that all is one. Now remember that we're talking about absolute reality. We're not talking about relative or sometimes or holiday reality. We're talking about all the time, absolute, everywhere reality. We're talking about a category that is so big that all the particulars fit inside of it, and there's nothing left over. This explains everything. Everything fits in this idea. So if everything is one, it means I am you, if everything is one. And I am the moon, and I am this table. And if I drink, it's God putting God into God, and there is no motion, because all is one. Now, if all is one, there is no disagreement. There cannot be any disagreement. There's no misunderstanding. There's no jealousy. There's no hatred. There's no war. There's no fear. which all sounds very nice. All the problems are solved if everything is one. One of the greatest ways that we suffer is alienation. And so the picture from the first circle is the drop of water. That each of us are like a drop of water that is separated and distinct and discrete. Here is this drop, and it's separated from the ocean. And it suffers. It has worries. It worries about evaporation, particularly. But also it has longings that are not fulfilled. Because it's water, it longs to have fish swim in it, but it's too small. And it feels isolated and threatened and unfulfilled because it has its own individual identity. And so it suffers horribly. What is the solution for the drop of water? It should go back into the ocean and become one with the all. And then fish will swim in it and it will never evaporate. You see, this is a gospel. And when it's preached in emotional terms, you weep. It's so inviting. Peace. Become one with the all. Be fulfilled in your being, because your being is in unity with all being. It's very, very attractive. It is the false prophet that cries, peace, peace, when there is no peace. And it's very, very strong. And when I have more time, I really go into this until the students get frightened, because it's so strong and it's so attractive, this piece. And then everyone really wants out, and then we have a good discussion. But I don't know if we have so much time. I would like to let you interrupt me for clarification, but I'm afraid we run out of time if I do it. So if it's really urgent, interrupt me. Don't let me lose you. Don't just check out and say, no, I can't hear this. If you think that's going to happen, stop me and say, wait, could you connect me again? And I will, because that's so important. In Buddhism, there are four spiritual laws. They're different from the four spiritual laws of Campus Crusade. But there are four spiritual laws. And the first spiritual law of Buddhism is the spiritual law of suffering. Everybody suffers. Everything suffers. We don't have a perfect experience. We suffer in all kinds of different ways. There is fear, loneliness, alienation, jealousy, unfulfilled desires, pain, sickness, and death. So every moment of everybody's and everything's life is full of suffering. The second noble truth is the cause of suffering. Do any of you know what the cause of suffering is? What the second noble truth is? Often there's someone who knows. Can you guess what is the cause of suffering?
Wish or desire?
Yes, it could. If you think of the drop of water, the cause of suffering is desire. Desire causes suffering. If there is no desire, there is no suffering. If there is desire, there is suffering. I'll give you an example. If I have a toothache and I desire that the pain will stop, and the pain does not stop, I suffer. If I have a toothache and I do not desire that the pain will stop, and the pain does not stop, I do not suffer. I do not. If I become one with the pain, if I say, pain is, I am, pain is, all is one, I do not suffer. Now I have to really convince myself, you know, I have to really be sincere, but then I do not suffer.
When the person doesn't experience this pain a lot, he doesn't feel it, it's present then.
There is pain, but no suffering. See, because the suffering is caused by the desire that the pain will stop, because it doesn't stop. But if there is pain and I accept the pain, I don't desire that it will stop, then I don't suffer. So when I came here to do this seminar, I had desires. I desired that we would understand each other. I desired that God would bless you and that there would be a benefit from our time together. I desired that I would not just confuse you and cause problems for you. I desired that you would like me. So I suffered because I didn't know the answer. I didn't know the outcome to anything. So I'm a little nervous. I mean, I didn't suffer horribly, but there's a little bit of unease and a little bit nervous. Well, if I really was aware that I am you, I would be as calm as the Dalai Lama coming in here. There would be no suffering. There would be no anxiety. There would be no desires about you. I wouldn't desire anything about you because I am you. Because all is one. You see how that works? You see how powerful that is? And maybe you feel even how attractive that is. Why someone would want to believe that. Someone would accept that as a gospel, as a way of salvation. That we can be one with everything. And it certainly implies a profound peace. I'm one with the all. But it means that there is no meaning. If everything is one, then there are no relationships. In order for there to be relationships, there has to be diversity. Meaning is relationships. That's what meaning means. It means relationships. And if there are no relationships, there is no meaning. There is no communicating. If I talk to you, I talk to myself because I am you. If I travel to Russia, I travel inside myself because I am the earth. And so there is no motion, there are no relationships, all is one, there is total peace, but no meaning. So in order to have this salvation, you have to give up meaning. So in order to have the salvation of the Bible, you have to give up something. But in order to have this salvation, you have to give up meaning, purpose, desire, ambition, planning, goals. None of it works. There has to be a static peace. When in America, the Transcendental Meditation Society of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi were trying to introduce Transcendental Meditation into the public schools as a therapy, then some Christians made a research about it, and they discovered that the mantras that are used in the therapy are not only sounds, but they are Sanskrit words, and they are prayers to Krishna. And so it could be proven that it's a religion and put out of the schools, because you're not allowed to be religious in American schools. This was good and right, but the Christians stopped too soon. They didn't realize the extent of the power of the mantra. Do you know mantra? But like Manu Shari or Aum Mane Padme Aum. You see, you feel it. It's strong. It's Aum, the jewel in the lotus. The purpose of mantra is not worship. And this is the level that the Christians discovered, that there was worship going on, and so it was religious. But the basic purpose of mantra is to destroy language, because language is relationship. Symbol and what is represented and communication, all kinds of relationships are involved in language. And if there is language, then everything is not one. And so in order to arrive at a real absolute unity, language has to be destroyed and eliminated. So what mantra does is to take sounds that have meaning, words that are meaningful, and repeat them aloud, and then repeat them inside the head silently until they become just a buzz, just a vibration, until they become the vibration of the quanta, the vibration of the electrons changing orbit in the atoms in the cosmos. So they become the basic primary movement vibration of all reality, and then you become one with the all. So it begins with language, which is the enemy. Jesus is the what? The Word. What's the first thing we learn about God in the Bible? He speaks. The thing that the devil attacks is language, the Word. That's the battle. Is there Word or is there not Word? Is there relationship or not relationship? Okay? So the purpose of mantra is to destroy language so that there is just the vibration. And pardon me?
Got a question.
Yeah.
If the purpose of mantra is to destroy the language, then mantra is in itself a language and brings meaning. I think it's quite contradictory.
Well, it begins
the definition of language.